Modern Love, the podcast, is made possible with support from Living Proof.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Fact: hair can absorb more than a third of its weight in water, which is a recipe for disaster on a humid day. Only Living Proof's Humidity Shield will save you from looking like a frizz ball. Use the code NOFRIZZ at livingproof.com for a free travel-size humidity shield with your $20 order. We are the science. You are the living proof. And by Squarespace. Whether for business or just for the fun of it, Squarespace offers easy-to-create websites with award-winning templates and 24/7 support. Start a free trial today. Go to squarespace.com and remember to enter offer code MODERNLOVE to get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace. Set your website apart.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Sometimes in life and in love, it's not about what someone says or does to us. It's about how we respond. Laura Munson had to remind herself of this when her marriage experienced a plot twist. Alicia Reiner brings us Laura's story. She's best known as Natalie Figueroa, or Fig, on the Netflix series Orange is the New Black. She's also the star of Equity, a new movie about the women of Wall Street. Here's Alicia reading Laura Munson's essay, "Those Aren't Fighting Words, Dear."
Let's say you have what you believe to be a healthy marriage. You're still friends and lovers after spending more than half of your lives together. The dreams you set out to achieve in your 20s, gazing into each other's eyes in candlelit city bistros when you were single and skinny, have for the most part come true. 2 decades later, you have the 20 acres of land, the farmhouse, the children, the dogs, and horses. You're the parents you said you would be, full of love and guidance. You've done it all. Disneyland, camping, Hawaii, Mexico, city living, stargazing. Sure, you have your marital issues, but on the whole, you feel so self-satisfied about how things have worked out that you would never, in your wildest nightmares, think you would hear these words from your husband one fine summer day. "I don't love you anymore. I'm not sure I ever did. I'm moving out. The kids will understand. They'll want me to be happy." But wait, this isn't the divorce story you think it is. Neither is it a begging him to stay story. It's a story about hearing your husband say, "I don't love you anymore," and deciding not to believe him, and what can happen as a result. Here's a visual. A child throws a temper tantrum, tries to hit his mother, but the mother doesn't hit back, lecture, or punish. Instead, she ducks. Then she tries to go about her business as if the tantrum isn't happening. She doesn't reward the tantrum. She simply doesn't take the tantrum personally. Because, after all, it's not about her. Let me be clear. I'm not saying my husband was throwing a child's tantrum. No, he was in the grip of something else. Profound and far more troubling meltdown that comes not in childhood, but in midlife, when we perceive that our personal trajectory is no longer arcing reliably upward as it once did. But I decided to respond the same way I'd responded to my children's tantrums. And I kept responding to it that way for 4 months. I don't love you anymore. I'm not sure I ever did. His words came at me like a speeding fist, like a sucker punch. Yet somehow, in that moment, I was able to duck. And once I recovered and composed myself, I managed to say, I don't buy it. Because I didn't. He drew back in surprise. Apparently, he'd expected me to burst into tears, to rage at him, to threaten him with a custody battle or beg him to change his mind. So he turned mean. I don't like what you've become. Gut-wrenching pause. How could he say such a thing? That's when I really wanted to fight, to rage, to cry. But I didn't. Instead, a shroud of calm enveloped me, and I repeated those words. I don't buy it. You see, I'd recently committed to a non-negotiable understanding with myself. I'd committed to the end of suffering. I'd finally managed to exile the voices in my head that told me my personal happiness was only as good as my outward success, rooted in things that were often outside my control. I'd seen the insanity of that equation and decided to take responsibility for my own happiness. And I mean all of it. My husband hadn't yet come to this understanding with himself. He had enjoyed many years of hard work, and its rewards had supported our family of four all along. But his new endeavor hadn't been going so well, and his ability to be the breadwinner was in rapid decline. He'd been miserable about this, felt useless, was losing himself emotionally, and letting himself go physically. And now he wanted out of our marriage, to be done with our family. But I wasn't buying it. I said, there are times in every relationship where the parties involved need a break. What can we do to give you the distance you need without hurting the family? Huh? He said. Go trekking in Nepal. Build a yurt in the back meadow. Turn the garage studio into a man cave. Get that drum set you've always wanted. Anything but hurting the children and me with a reckless move like the one you're talking about. How can we have responsible distance? I don't want distance, he said. I want to move out. My mind raced. Was it another woman, drugs, unconscionable secrets? But I stopped myself. I would not suffer. Instead, I went to my desk, Googled responsible separation, and came up with a list. It included things like who's allowed to use what credit cards? Who are the children allowed to see you with in town? Who's allowed keys to what? I looked through the list and passed it on to him. I remained stoic. I could see pain in his eyes, pain I recognized. Oh, I see what you're doing. He said, you're gonna make me go into therapy. You're not gonna let me move out. You're gonna use the kids against me. I never said that. I just asked, what can we do to give you the distance you need? Stop saying that! Well, he didn't move out. Instead, he spent the summer being unreliable. He stopped coming home at his usual 6 o'clock. He would stay out late and not call. He blew off our entire 4th of July, the parade, the barbecue, the fireworks, to go to someone else's party. When he was home, he was distant. He wouldn't look me in the eye. He didn't even wish me happy birthday. But I didn't play into it. I walked my line. I told the kids, Daddy's having a hard time, as adults often do, but we're a family, no matter what. My trusted friends were irate on my behalf. How can you just stand by and accept this behavior? Kick him out. Get a lawyer. I walked my line with them, too. This man was hurting. Yet his problem wasn't mine to solve. In fact, I needed to get out of his way so he could solve it. Okay, I know what you're thinking. I'm a pushover. I'm weak and scared and would put up with anything to keep my family together. But I can assure you, I'm not. I load 1,500-pound horses into trailers and gallop through the high country of Montana all summer. I went through Pitocin-induced natural childbirth and a cesarean section without follow-up drugs. I am handy with a chainsaw. I simply had come to the understanding that I was not at the root of my husband's problem. He was. Privately, I decided to give him time. 6 months. I had good days, and I had bad days. On the good days, I took the high road. I ignored his lashing out, his merciless jabs. On bad days, I would fester in the August sun while the kids ran through sprinklers, raging at him in my mind. But I never wavered. Although it may sound ridiculous to say don't take it personally when your husband tells you he no longer loves you, sometimes that's exactly what you have to do. Instead of issuing ultimatums, yelling, crying, or begging, I presented him with options. I created a summer of fun for our family and welcomed him to sharing it or not. It was up to him. If he chose not to come along, we would miss him, but we would be just fine, thank you very much. And we were. And yeah, you can bet I wanted to sit him down and persuade him to stay, to love me, to fight for what we've created. You can bet I wanted to. But I didn't. I barbecued. I made lemonade. I set the table for four. I loved him from afar. And one day, there he was, home from work early. Mowing the lawn. A man doesn't mow his lawn if he's gonna leave it. Not this man. Then he fixed a door that had been broken for 8 years. He made a comment about our front porch needing paint. Our front porch. He mentioned needing wood for next winter, the future. Little by little, he started talking about the future. It was Thanksgiving dinner that sealed it. My husband bowed his head humbly and said, "I'm thankful for my family." He was back. And I saw what had been missing. Pride. He'd lost pride in himself. Maybe that's what happens when our egos take a hit in midlife and we realize we're not as young and golden anymore. When life's knocked us around and our childhood myths reveal themselves to be just that. The truth feels like the biggest sucker punch of them all. It's not a spouse or land or a job or money that brings us happiness. Those achievements, those relationships can enhance our happiness, yes, but happiness has to start from within. Relying on any other equation can be lethal. My husband had become lost in the myth, but he found his way out. We've since had the hard conversations. In fact, he encouraged me to write about our ordeal to help other couples who arrive at this juncture in life, people who feel scared and stuck, who believe their temporary feelings are permanent, who see an easy out and think they can escape. My husband tried to strike a deal, blame me for his pain, unload his feelings of personal disgrace onto me. But I ducked, and I waited, and it worked.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Alicia Reiner, reading Laura Munson's essay, "Those Aren't Fighting Words, Dear." It's been 7 years since Laura's story was published. We'll hear from her about what's happened since after the break.
Support for Modern Love, the podcast, comes from Living Proof, the science behind healthy hair.
I'm Katie from Living Proof, and we get love letters all the time, like this one. Dear Living Proof, the products for curls are amazing. Third day in a row that a complete stranger walked up to me and complimented my hair. I use the leave-in conditioner, a little mousse, and a minute or two with the diffuser. Incredible. Your products are lifesavers. Love, Maureen. Use the code NOFRIZZ for a free travel-sized humidity shield with your $20 order. Livingproof.com.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And now a postscript from the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, Daniel Jones, and the author of this week's essay, Laura Munson.
After the piece was published, my marriage came up for air. But then, ultimately, it needed to end, and so I got to practice this philosophy again, but this time it was in post-divorce reinvention.
So the marriage didn't last. Laura's relationship ended 4 years after the piece came out, but she stayed in Montana with her children and approached her creative work with renewed energy.
So out of all this, I created Haven Writing Retreats, which I lead 10 times a year here in Montana. And I love helping people find their voice and use writing as the transformational tool that it is. And a special coda in all this is that in doing all this work, I met a wonderful man, and I'm very much in love. And my kids are stable, our home life is stable, and it's flourishing. And so it's a pretty exceptional time in my life.
What I find powerful about Laura's essay isn't about did she keep the man, did she win him in the end and win him back. A lot of people will want to read that into it. I think it's more a strategy for being happy without someone and loving yourself on a basic level, regardless of others' opinions and choices.
So people ask me all the time, how is it that you were able to meet your husband with those words, "I don't buy it"? Where did I learn that? I learned that from dealing with years of rejection in my field, which is pretty much par for the course for any artist, especially writers. And so I had been in a lot of pain for a long time, basing my happiness on things outside of my control. And once I started working with this philosophy that we can powerfully choose our emotions no matter what's going on in our life, that there's a gap between the things that people say and do to us and our emotional reaction to them, then suddenly everything changed for me. That 6-month period when I got to live that way was one of the most powerful and emotionally liberated times in my life. So in no way am I suggesting that people should go into denial or sweep their emotions underneath the rug. Not at all. What I'm saying is, if I'm going to freak out about something emotionally, I want to powerfully choose that freak out. I don't want it to choose me, and there's a big difference between the two.
You know, readers respond to this essay en masse and with great emotion, and it was not by any means all positive. I would say, you know, it was half positive and half people saying, "Who are you kidding?" or saying, "He's cheating on you." The amount of presumption about someone else's life that people try to glean from, you know, 1,500 words. And in her case, you know, it just doesn't affect her at a certain level. The old phrase of you can't control other people's emotions, you can only control your own, you can't control other people's reactions, only your own. I just think that's such a hard lesson to learn, but a valuable lesson.
I'm glad I had my passions in a row, even though my ducks weren't. And my message to people is, don't wait to find your passions when the world starts to fall apart around you and the rug gets pulled out from underneath you. Find your passions now and live into them, and you might just be living a beautifully abundant life.
Laura Munson, author of Those Aren't Fighting Words, Dear. She tells the full story in her memoir, This Is Not the Story You Think It Is. We also heard from Modern Love editor Dan Jones. Special thanks to Alicia Reiner for reading this week's essay. You can see her in season 4 of Orange is the New Black, which comes out on Netflix this Friday. She also co-produced and stars in the new film Equity, a story about the women of Wall Street, which is out in theaters July 29th. Well, we know you love listening to Modern Love, but do you want to see Modern Love live in action? This Thursday, June 16th, we're doing an event in New York City at WNYC's Green Space as part of their women's podcast festival, Work It. We'll have Modern Love essays performed live and a Q&A with editor Daniel Jones and with the producers of the podcast. Now, the event is sold out, but it will be live streamed. So join us at 7 p.m. New York City time on Thursday, June 16th. The streaming link is at our website, wbur.org/modernlove. Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Our casting consultant is Amy Lippins. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week. If you love Modern Love, check out WBUR's advice podcast, Dear Sugar, where hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond answer all your questions, no matter how deep or dark. Subscribe to Dear Sugar on iTunes or your favorite podcast app.
Squarespace is proud to help make modern love possible. Please visit squarespace.com and build your own website. Whether you need a landing page, a beautiful gallery, a professional blog, or an online store, it's all available and easy to build. Start your free trial today. And remember to use the code MODERNLOVE for 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace. Set your website apart.